This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. Free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. All right, that is the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the making loving kindness, or doing loving kindness, which is a good thing to do before every meditation, and I always recommend doing a bit of it, 5 minutes or anything, before every... That's how I was trained. That's how Bhante-ji, my preceptor, did all his meditations. He always started with a little meditation, whether he did it silently or guided people. And when I first came here, I did it that way, and two monks told me I was doing it wrong, that I should never mix the Karaniya Metta Sutta and some other sutta like breath meditation. Well, that's not true at all. And I have proof from Bhante-ji, who is a very well-known meditator and metta monk, as they call them. And I'm certain of what I'm doing, and I advise you that it's a very good idea and a way to get relaxed to meditate. All right, so Chris said that we were going to do a half hour meditation now. Actually, I didn't plan for a half hour of meditation, and so I was only going to do a little bit of talking about meditation and how to get restarted if you're having problems. You know, when you're cooking, you don't eat the same thing every day. So variety works with meditation the same way. You want to add a little spice to your meditation, the same as you do with cooking, and change things once in a while. So number one thing to consider is posture. You have four postures, and They were just mentioned in the Karaniya Metta Sutta. You have sitting down, you have standing, you have walking, and you have lying down. You have all those postures to consider. Now, if you're usually sitting, which most people are, if you sit on the floor, you might consider sometimes varying that and sitting on a chair. I'm just going to give a number of things for possibility, that you might always, during your meditation, if you're meditating for a long time, as you do in retreats, you might alternate the walking meditation with the sitting meditation. Do a bit of sitting meditation and then walk a while if you have a place to walk. Okay, and now another thing, why would anyone want to stand and do meditation? But remember, there are statues of the Buddha standing straight up. Those are meditation postures of the Buddha. And you can, if you're tired or sleepy, you can stand up for a while and see if it wakes you up, makes you more wakeful, and then sit back down, or you can just stand wherever you are. You might be out in nature or something like that. You might just do, it might not be convenient to sit down. So consider the possibility of just standing and not walking for a while. What else? Now, lying down. Lying down is a little tricky because you might fall asleep. And the statues show the Buddha lying on his right side with his hands up, something like that. Or I guess one arm is down, and he's lying like that. And those are two postures, depending on the position of his feet. And one of them is Parinibbana, which means that he's passed from the worldly life and has gone to the Nibbana. And I believe that that is with the feet together, but I may be wrong on that. So the other posture is with one foot behind the other. And I believe that is a meditation posture, but I could be wrong on that. I didn't do in my research, and I was just going from memory. But either way, you don't have to meditate on your side. That was the Buddha's way of doing it. But you can, for instance, if you go to sleep sleeping on your side, then you might lie down flat with your on your back with your head down, and you're a lot less likely to fall asleep lying on your back. And I've been trying to train myself that way to meditate on my back, because I've had some ill health and I had to lie down in my back a lot. And it's difficult if you're not used to it, and it takes some persistence, but it's worth it as a variation, especially as you get old. So I recommend working on that, especially if you see you might need it. And you might try sleeping on, instead of on a soft surface like the bed, you might try sleeping on a hard surface like a floor, obviously, or a floor with a carpet on it, or maybe just a pad or something that's a lot different from your bed so that it doesn't put you to sleep. Okay, so those are the postures you might consider varying. Another obvious one is kamatana, are the meditation objects. So the subject that you pick for meditation, like breath, that's a kamatana, or what you see in your mind. So one is metta. We just talked about metta and doing metta. You can do just, may I be happy, may I be happy. and so on. Yeah, especially if you don't feel so good about yourself or you're not feeling well, you might do some self-metta meditation. You might also vary it with the five classic meditation subjects in metta, which are the self, first of all. You always start with the self, and because, as Bhante-ji said, if you don't have metta towards yourself, you can hardly have it towards other people. The second person is the mentor, or some person you greatly admire. And it doesn't have to be somebody you know, necessarily. I mean, personally, no. But it may be your teacher. It might be, for me, it might be Bhante Gunaratana or Ajahn Brahm. The third person would be a good friend. And the next person, not your spouse, though. This is one thing about this is that we don't want to work on doing metta with family members, really, because it's a different kind of loving kindness. It's the kind of loving kindness that extends to all beings, and not just to our family members. So then the fourth would be we did good friend, and the next one would be a neutral person, a person we may see every day and know them, but we don't have any personal feelings about them one way or the other because we've never interacted with them. And so we do the neutral person and extend loving kindness to that person. The last person on the usual list, the classical list, would be the adversary, somebody we have difficulties with. We can call that person the enemy if we wish, or the adversary. And if we don't have anyone in our personal life, like at work or somewhere, you're very fortunate and you can pick somebody from the news. It doesn't have to be somebody you know personally, but you can extend your loving kindness to that person. And then we've added another one, which would be all living beings. You can extend loving kindness to all living beings. So that's another possibility of varying and adding metta to your meditation, or doing metta for the whole meditation. The next is another one that is a little unusual is parts of the body. There are, 32 or 62? I can't remember now because I'm very forgetful. But the one that I was advised and I've heard of, and it's very, very interesting one, is the skull. This is the one that people start with, and it's the most beautiful of all, because if you meditate on the skull enough, the skull, just a human skull, it becomes a nimitta. And if you're familiar with a nimitta, it's an image that's produced by the mind based on what you've been looking at, except that it's very pure like a jewel, like a diamond. It's very bright and pure. And so it doesn't have any connotation of terror or death about it. It's just a very beautiful object. So I could recommend that. You might try that, but don't just give up. But I mean, don't do it unless you're going to persist in it for a little while and see if it gives you any results. Another possibility for subjects is the four elements. The four ancient elements of earth, fire, air, water. Those elements you can meditate on. The way that I learned it in a retreat in particular was to do it while walking. And you would have to find a recording of someone linking, I think Ayakema has one, you're linking the foot, the way the foot goes up, moves forward and goes down. You're linking that with the four elements. In other words, it might be air going up and water going forwards and earth going down, or something like that. You'll have to find that to do it, and it's very interesting. You do it slowly, and you link each one of the four. I won't go into why you would do such a thing, but this is a classic meditation that's done by many people, the four element meditation. Okay, another thing you can change is you might change the location. If you're always doing it at home, it's a good thing to have a meditation place, but you might want to try meditation in a different location. Say it could be out in nature in a park, it could be on a vacation, while you're in the mountains, in the forest, at a beach, or someplace, as long as you're alone and not disturbed, you might try that for a change. Or if you're at home and you're having problems meditating, you might just go outside somewhere to an unusual place and meditate there. All right, then if you're used to meditating at one time of day, like the morning, you might vary that and meditate. If you're having some problems and you want to change things a bit, you might meditate the morning and the evening, or you might meditate just in the evening or late at night. You might consider that as a possibility, a way of changing things. And the frequency, the time and the frequency. You might try, this is an obvious one, but you might, if you don't already use recorded meditations, you might use some recorded meditations instead of doing them on your own all the time. Just once in a while, do that, maybe do that anyway. Another one, the last one, has to do with relaxation, which is really a preparation for meditation. And I say that because Ayakema has a great hour-long meditation on the whole body. I've never succeeded in staying awake through the whole thing. And it goes through every part very slowly. And she explains it as she goes down from the top of the head all the way down and the shoulders and so on, down, all the way down to the feet. That's a wonderful meditation. Well, it's really a relaxation and a preparation, but you can try doing that once in a while, especially if you need it. If you need relaxation, you should always, and I don't think I've criticized myself for not mentioning relaxation right at the beginning of your meditation. Be sure to relax your whole body from the head down to the feet and in whatever way that you want. There are different ways to meditate, to relax yourself. And it's a good thing to start with. It's not a very good idea to start your meditation and continue your meditation tense. And I know from a retreat I was at, when I it was a long retreat, and I had a horrible pain in my, up here in my shoulder. It felt like somebody was stabbing me with a knife. And it went on for days, and it was merely tension, and that I hadn't really relaxed enough. And because the meditation itself was somewhat difficult, I had tensed up there and not known it, and wasn't aware of it. So you have to really pay attention to the parts of your body. And once in a while you're meditating, you can check out your body and make sure you're relaxed. Especially your face muscles. People forget that. But don't tense up your face. You don't want to tense up any part, but especially your face muscles. And the muscles that tend to get tensed up around your shoulders and your stomach and your back and so on. And work on your posture as well. I'll throw that in too. You should sit as straight as possible, straight up and down, keeping your head balanced. Otherwise, it's not just to be good, it's to, so you don't have problems with your neck and back, a small of your back later. You want to keep the small of your back, the lordosis, curved so that it doesn't put a pressure on your neck. So keep your back straight up and down. And if you need to, and if you're sitting, have somebody check you, looking at your side, and tell you if you're straight up and down, or hold a meter stick up to your back, and you can feel whether you're... Because people generally sit forward, and they think they're sitting straight up and down, right? You may not know that, but you can try yourself. And actually, you should sit back a bit and have somebody try it, or sit against a wall and try it that way, and prove to yourself. All right, now that pretty much concludes what I wanted to say about meditation. And my idea was to go on to, well, I guess the timing isn't too bad, is to go on to the meditation, excuse me, it's very wet outside, and I tend to have a little trouble with that in the sinuses. It's also time for what they call hay fever, Now, I'd like to start the meditation, and we're meditating for a half hour. The question is, what do you want to do? Do you want to do breathing meditation? And
does anybody have a preference?
Because that's what I'll pick if you don't say that you want something, nothing radical, but that's what I would pick, breathing meditation. And I'm assuming. I'm assuming every. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, it sounds perfect, Ajahn. Breathing meditation.
Okay. All right. And I'm assuming that everybody knows how to. Do you need a refresher course on how to do breathing meditation, Anapanasati, in and out breath meditation?
I think that would be wonderful, Ajahn, if you would.
You would. No. Okay. You want to, okay, for those who haven't done it recently or don't know how to do it, you're simply breathing on the breath, and you're not doing yogic breathing, you're not doing any kind of manipulation of the breath, you're not breathing faster or slower than you usually do, you're not holding your breath, and you don't have to center your concentration on any particular place in your body like your stomach. I know that some people do that. That's all right. If you want to do that, okay. If you're used to doing it by putting your attention on your nose, okay. Ajahn Brahmo, he says, well, that's body meditation. That's meditation on your nose or something like that. But if you want to do that, that's all right. It's your meditation, so whatever keeps your attention up. But the important thing is that you're not meditating on a body part, you're meditating on the breath, just the breath. As you normally breathe, you can just do a normal in and out breath, and if you do that, that's what you're concentrating on, a normal in breath and then a normal out breath. And the idea is you pay attention. If you've ever seen the steps, the method, basic method of meditation, Ajahn Brahm's book, he goes through the basic steps. But you start out and you'll have thoughts in your mind, and then you'll put all, and then you're doing your breath meditation, but you'll still have thoughts in your mind, and then you go beyond this You go beyond into no thoughts in your mind, just the breath, and you pay attention to every segment of the breath, like the pauses and the holds and how long they are, and you don't try to change them, you just observe. You observe every part of the breath. These are, this give you some things, whether you're breathing slow or fast, the tempo, and you observe these things as the breath goes on. And you continue breathing on and on, and for a half hour, that's probably as far as we'll get. And if you want to see the other steps, you can get that. I know there's a link now that somebody found about 3 or 4 weeks ago to the Basic Method of Meditation by Ajahn Brahm, and it will explain to you in detail the different steps that you do in the Basic Method of Meditation. So you're just paying attention to your out-breath and your in-breath. Does anyone have any questions? At this point, I need a question in order to elaborate. I'm not sure what you don't know. If it's what part isn't clear to you if you haven't done it before. No, I won't be guiding you very much.
Would anybody like to ask a question? Is anything about breath meditation that you would like to know? Julia would like to ask you a question, Ajahn.
Yes.
Ajahn, so I wondered if it's whether it's important or if it doesn't matter at all whether you breathe through your nose or out through your mouth or in through your nose, out through your mouth. Whether that has anything to do with anything.
No, that's a kind of yogic breath where you hold one side. You can remember that. We're not doing that, but that's a very interesting meditation if you're doing pranayama. You do one side and then another, and that. We're not doing that. No, there's no special way to breathe. It's just a normal way that you would breathe ordinarily. That you're breathing now, you're not breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. That is a manipulation they do in pranayama, I'm pretty sure. No, we're not doing any of those kinds of breathing. We're just breathing in a normal way.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So with that, I will start. Once in a while, I'll coach a little bit to keep you on the track. And we'll start out with 5 minutes or so of meditation. We'll start out with metta meditation. So now we'll start the meditation with loving kindness, however you want to do it. And you can link it to the breath. You can link it however you wish. On the in-breath, you can think in your mind, may I be happy on the out-breath, happy on the out-breath. May I be happy. And you can continue with giving yourself metta meditation, or you can vary it by sending the meditation, the metta, to other people, whoever you pick, or to the whole world, or to beings in the whole world. You just meditate. May I be happy. And when your mind begins to think of other things to think about, just bring it back to the metta. May all beings, may all members of this meditation class be happy. May all members of this meditation class be happy. May all beings of this meditation class be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings living in the world be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. All right, now we'll start the Anapanasati in and out breathing meditation. Remember that watch your posture, keep your back straight. Relax your whole body, make sure there's no tension in any suspect place like your shoulders or your face. Keep your face relaxed. Remember that if you hear noises, any noises, just let them exist. Just let them come and let them go. Whatever comes, let it come. whatever goes, let it go. Don't hold on to anything and consider it. Just whatever comes, see it and let it go. And the same with thoughts. Just as if they were noises on the outside of from the street. The thoughts, just let them come. You can see them and let them pass. Don't hold on to them and consider them. Just let them go. Return to silence. Watch the breathing. As it goes in and out, how long is the breath? How long is the in-breath? How long is the out-breath? How long is the pause after the in-breath? How long is the pause after the out-breath? How do they vary? Is one shorter than the other? If your breathing changes tempo, that's all right. Just notice that. Oh, now my breathing is slower. Or now my breathing is quicker. Look at the breathing, the in and out breath. No judgments. All right, now continue the in and out breath. Keep your mind focused on the breath. If it should wander off, bring it back gently. Without judgment, just notice what took you away that time. What are you attaching yourself to? Let all those attachments, whether the past, or the future, or the present, whether they have to do with people in your family or at your work, just let that go. All that can be dealt with later. Yeah. the Buddha's favorite meditation. The breath that leads you to the jhanas. Be guided by your breath. Ride along on the breath. You can imagine the breath entering as a kind of energy in pranayama. Prana means pana, means anapanasati. It means the breath, but it means more than just the physical breath. It's a kind of pure energy that enters the body or enters the mind. You can imagine that as a kind of electricity flowing into your mind, or a kind of fire that goes into your mind and energizes it, this prana, or pana. You can imagine that coming in as you breathe in. If pure energy is coming in, if it's not impeded with thinking, Are you noticing how the breath changes? Is the breath changing? Are the pauses changing? May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. As it says in the Metta Sutta, Karaniya Metta Sutta, whatever living beings there may be, and that it describes, of all descriptions. And so we'll bring this meditation to a conclusion. And if you decide to turn the lights back on, do it gently so you don't hurt yourself, don't hurt your eyes. If anyone has any questions about meditation, then you can ask, or any observations or opinions or whatever, what have you.
This is a wonderful opportunity to ask any questions you might like to ask.
Now, excuse me.
Can I ask them?
I'm sorry?
Please.
I was just going to ask Bhante about Ayakama.
Yes.
That you mentioned. I'm not familiar.
No. Well, she was a woman who attained jhana and taught in the 90s, mainly, 1990s. And she was a Jewish person who had to get out of Germany along with her family. And she relocated in California and then met a man. And they traveled around and she became interested in meditation and so on. It's a long story, but she has a great, I Give You My Life is the name of her autobiography, if you want to read about her. And she attained jhanas and taught all over the world. She was great.
How do you spell that? Is it her name?
K-H-E-M-A, I think.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Aya is just A-Y-Y-A, I believe.
Yeah,
I'm not the best speller. Ayakama, if you go into any Buddhist place or on the internet and you look up Buddhism and so on, you'll find Ayakama mentioned.
Thank you. That's great.
All right. If there are no other questions. Oh, yeah. Pindar.
Sometimes it's Ajahn, sometimes it's Ayakama, K-H-E-M-M-A.
I didn't understand. I can't understand. I can't understand. Say it again.
Sorry. No, sometimes it's spelled with two N's. K-H-E-M-M-A.
Oh, is it? Okay, good.
Sometimes.
Thank you. So sometimes, well. Kama is a Pali word, so Kama. Could be, yeah, two M's probably is right. Thank you. Ayakama, right. Pali word.
Sometimes even the most simple questions are the most meaningful, so.
Kama, yeah. I have a friend whose name Kama Ratana. And that means the jewel of gentleness, I think Kama means, but I'm not sure. Ratana means jewel. All right, so I will begin my talk then. If nobody has any more questions about meditation, Going once.
Well, that would be wonderful if you'd like to continue your talk, okay. Ajahn.
Okay, well, this talk is about purification of the mind. And there is a saying in the Dhammapada, which is a book of short verses, which I recommend greatly. The Dhammapada is one of the scriptures. This is the verse, do no evil, cultivate good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. I'll say it again. Do no evil, cultivate good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So what we're going to look at is one way, one factor, purification of the mind, which is very important. And it's generally translated as cognitive distortion, which is a complicated way of saying the things that are dirtying or messing up your thinking processes. All right, and it's called, the main ones that we want to consider is called in the scriptures vipalasa. And that's a Pali word that's generally translated as cognitive distortions, or in the scriptures they call it inversions, which is a fancy way of saying turned upside down. That's all it means. Vipalasa means just seeing the world upside down. And what the implication is that we see the world upside down. That's what vipalasa indicates. Now, there are four vipalasas, but where in the thinking process do they take place? So we've got, if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, it starts out, the first factor is right view. So we've got right view is number one, and you can say we're numbering them in order. And under it, factor number two in the Noble Eightfold Path is right thought, right? And so then we also have, along with that, right as number three, right perception. Now, if you if you look in the scriptures, you'll find one of the scriptures says, one of the suttas describes the perception, the part of our being, our five separate parts. Perception is described as I'm blanking out now. What you see on the desert when you see something.
A mirage,
yes, okay. Okay, you see a mirage, and there is something producing the mirage. There's something there, but it's been distorted, all right? So perception has been distorted. Now, view affects and causes the perceptions to be the way they are. I said view, thought, perception. Views, the views that we have are those controlling, what would you call them, philosophical ideas. And in fact, number one sutta, in the number one sutta, not the number one collection of suttas is the all-entangling subject of views. And it lists, I think, the 62 different views. And these were philosophical ideas from the time of the Buddha that you can look at. But what we're concerned with are the ordinary views that we have, and we'll get to those in a minute. But the most important four of those. But what happens is that the perceptions then affect the thoughts. Remember I said views, thoughts, perceptions. So the perceptions work up and they control, change the thoughts. If your perceptions change, your thoughts will change, and your thoughts will change your views. And then the views will go around and change your perceptions again. It's a vicious circle, because if your views change, your perceptions change, and it'll work its way up. I think in computer programming, that's called a loop. A loop, and then it goes around and works its way up, and then the upper line of code is controlling, and it may affect one of the lower lines of code, and then everything will change all the way up. So it's something like that. What's that?
Also the feedback loops.
Yeah. Feedback loop. Yeah. That's what it is. So, okay, so that's what we're considering. We're considering the views. That's, as I said, right views, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's very important. The second is right thought. All right, so what are the four vipalasas are, and we're familiar with them because seeing the what is impermanent as permanent, I'm sure you've heard that before, seeing what is suffering as pleasure, seeing what has no self whatsoever and no essence as having a self, especially oneself, or other beings, other people. And we have a fourth one. Seeing what is disgusting and flawed as beautiful. Now, the first three are called the three signs, the tilakana in Pali. They're the three signs because when we have insights, and we have insights of them, we start seeing reality. Those are very important. And it lists the three, the first three, but it doesn't list beauty. But we can see by adding the vipalasas, they've added beauty because it shows the importance of physical desire in the physical world, sense desire, the beauty. So this caused me a problem because beauty is used in different ways. And I thought back, at the beginning of the 19th century, there was the Romantic movement, you know. It was in all the arts, but in particular in English literature, they had Wordsworth and Byron Keats and Coleridge and those, and they all talked about the highest ideal as being the good, the true, the beautiful. You may have heard about that. The good, the true, the beautiful. Now, wait a minute. It has beauty in it, but what do they mean? They don't mean physical beauty of another person. That's not what they mean. They mean the beauty you might compare to a beautiful star, or you might compare it to a beautiful jewel, a diamond that's been cut perfectly and has no flaws in it. So ultimately what they're talking about with beauty, when beauty is used in that way, it means purity. So I'm going to try to keep myself from saying beauty, and I'll try to say purity. And what I mean is the purity of a pure diamond, or even better, the purity of a nimitta. You know that when you get far enough in your meditation, you may or may not. Not everyone has nimittas, which are mental visions of something. And the classic one is, you can imagine seeing a full moon, a big full moon, a brilliant white full moon on a totally black night. And that's a classic nimitta. And that is pure. Nimittas are always pure and bright. And that's why we're attracted into them. And that's purity, the purity of a jewel. And that's why the Buddha Dhamma Sangha are called the three jewels, the Tiratana, and people are named after them. And not Buddha Ratana, however. They're only named Dhamma Ratana and Sangha Ratana. And they're just named for these jewels, the three jewels of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, Ratana. Why are they named after jewels or treasure? It's because of the brilliant purity that you find in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It's the purity that you don't find in earthly objects. It's in the mind, and it's what you go to. It's that purity that we're searching. Purify the mind, as I read before. Do no evil, cultivate good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So, the delusions, I'll read them again. I'll read them in a different order. Delusions of having a self. All right, I'm sure you've heard of that if you've studied any Dhamma at all. Delusions of permanence. Delusions of pleasure and not dukkha, not pain. And that implies, just to make it clear, is that all, if you know the Four Noble Truths, you know, you have to know the truth of dukkha, that there is suffering in the world. And some people, when you're trying to tell them about Buddhism, have a lot of trouble with that. And they say, well, the world isn't suffering. I mean, there is a lot of pleasure in the world. That's true, but all pleasure in the world, as all beauty, is flawed. It's not the purity, it's not the perfect beauty or the perfect purity of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And instead of saying that the good, true, the beautiful, they could say the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and add purity. The Buddha Dhamma Sangha and purity. Good, the true, the beautiful. The good, the true, the beautiful are these. Anyway, I hope you see what I'm talking about. All right, so. And the way that we get to an idea of these, as I said, is through insight, through meditation. You have to have insight in order to see the non-self, see some aspect of the non-self. Often, especially Ajahn Brahm will say that you need to have jhana. You can actually have perceptions of these without jhana to some extent, but not as strong. You have the four jhanas and you can have an insight of, especially after having the jhana, then you look back and you see what non-self means, and you see what the impermanence means. You'll see what it means if you meditate. It's not just an idea. It's not just a philosophical idea. It's something you have to experience in your own meditation, and that's why we're doing meditation. It's something you have to experience in order to break through the cognitive delusions of seeing the world upside down. That's what the whole thing's about. You meditate so you get the insight into what's upside down. And these four vipalasas are among the most important to have insights into. And that's why I brought it up. And it's part of what's called the first factor of dependent origination, which you probably heard of, and I'm not going to give a talk on that right now. But dependent origination starts with the factor of avijja, which means, it can mean ignorance and it can mean delusion. And it's what we're talking about now, is that we're deluded. I use that word instead of ignorance. That the delusion, the vipalasas are the most significant, in a sense, of the delusions. There are many other delusions. There are many other forms of ignorance. All of the kaleshas, what are called the imperfections in human beings. All those are part of that first factor. And so what we want to find out is we want to find out that the self, and to have a feeling that the self finally, if you want to make progress on the path, the four steps of sainthood, you have to have a feeling that there is no self, that this, what you consider a self in you, is just a thought and a perception at first, and you do get rid of the original, the view first. If you get rid of the view, then you've reached the stage of sotapanna, which means stream enter, along with some other factors. But that is like the most important one, to have that feeling, that view at least. As I said, the Noble Eightfold Path starts out with right view. Well, one of the right views, aside from the Noble Eightfold Path, is that there is no self, there is no essence, there is no soul that goes into heaven when you die and exists there permanently through eternity. But you have to have an insight in that to see what it means. It's not just an idea, like a philosophical idea. Because you could say Buddhism is not philosophy. It's something that you have to see and actually know from your meditation. All right? Very important. And then, all right, there's seeing that there's no self, and then there's seeing what is impermanent. And seeing what is impermanent may be the first insight that you may see. And you'll actually see what they're talking about, impermanence. What is that, anicca? What does it mean? What do they mean? Everybody knows everything's impermanent. I mean, trees fall down, they live for long, long, hundreds and hundreds of years, but they fall. Everybody knows that the mountains wear down. So what's there to know about impermanence? But there's a lot to know. Once you see impermanence, you see that every microsecond is impermanent, and you actually see that the things that are before you, and this would include yourself, but you actually see that they come and they go. I think of a fountain. My simile is a fountain. You know, a fountain shoots up, and then what's shot up falls down on the outside. Well, while the rest of the water is shooting up in the middle. You know what I mean by a fountain? Like Old Faithful, goes up and goes down. So it goes up there, and for just a short time it's suspended, and then it falls on the outside, right? Well, that's how everything that we perceive and everything that exists comes up and exists for an incredibly short amount of time before it falls away, with the famous saying, with the arising of this, there is the arising of this, and with the cessation of this, there is the cessation of this, right? As the thing, what comes up in the middle, the things that have come up are going out, and so on, right? And I hope I'm making it clear instead of more complicated, but anyway, this is, with the arising of this, there is the arising of this. With the cessation of this, the cessation of this. This is like the fountain shooting up and then falling again. Anyway, it's impermanent. The point I'm making is that it's impermanence, constant impermanence. All right, and then we have the other two suffering. All I can say about suffering and beauty is that whatever we think and we do, we have pleasure, but it's always flawed. Whatever beauty we see, if we look into anything physical, whatever beauty has flaws. Except the purity, the things that I said were pure. I was talking about the purity, that's the difference. Anything that we see in the world is that we consider beautiful ultimately is not beautiful and does not last as beauty. It decays and falls apart. Any kind of pleasure that we have, even the greatest pleasure, is filled with problems. For one thing, when it goes away, when the pleasure goes away, you're left with feeling desolate, for instance. All right, and how are we doing? We're getting close. All right, so we say we are successful on the Noble Eightfold Path, and we bring into our mind right view. We have right view. That means we're stream-enters, basically, if you have right view. However, a person who's a stream-enter may not have perfectly right thought and right perception yet. It may take a few lifetimes to align our thoughts and our perceptions with our view. Our view may be okay. We've seen. Yes?
Keep going. It's all right.
Okay, we're getting close.
Yeah, that's okay. Take your time. I'll wait for you.
Okay. We're getting close, and our technician has looked in. And so then we have, from thoughts, we have, we work through the other steps that have to do with thought, that come from thought and perception, that have to do with the physical world and our life. And then we get to the last three, which are, the three are called samadhi and effort. We have effort, mindfulness, and samadhi itself, or jhana. And those lead us into the purification. They mean, getting that far means that we have purified our thoughts and our perceptions in order to get that far. And we're going towards wisdom through the jhanas, ultimately. All right. So I'm going to bring it to an end and ask you if you have any questions about what we've talked about, or what I've talked about.
We have a message for you, Arjan,
yes,
from Laura Lee in Kobe. She says that your talk is so enlightening and that she learned so much from you today. So,
thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question or make a comment? I, for one, Arjan, liked the image of impermanence in the fountain going up and staying suspended for that moment, and then, chum.
Yes.
It's beautiful for impermanence. Thank you. Arjan, would you like to be so kind as to offer us all a blessing this evening? We'd be very grateful if you could.
A blessing? Yeah. I usually do it with water. I don't think that's what you want. A blessing is something nobody's ever asked me to do before, but I hope that in what I was thinking, this is what I was thinking in my mind, I only hope that this talk will convince everyone of the importance, if you weren't already convinced, of the importance of meditation and what it leads to. Purify the mind. Extremely important. And that's what it's all about. So my blessing is that you, not so much from my talk, but this talk will lead you into subjects that you can pursue on your own in the Dhamma and in other talks and in books and so on. And you will, and will lead you to ultimate enlightenment. And I wanted to say one other thing very quickly, is that Ajahn Mon, who was a very great monk from about 120 so years ago, there was a lay person and he was doing walking. Ajahn Mon was on a tudong, which means that he was walking around in the countryside for long distances. And this, he met a layperson who wanted to see a deva or something. And he told the layperson to sit down, and on his out-breath, he said to the layperson, "I've lost the Buddha. I've lost the Buddha." The Buddha means enlightenment. "I've lost enlightenment." You know, the Buddha, and then there's the Buddha. He said, on the out-breath, say to yourself, "Buddha." So I leave you with that.